Listening to The Drop and the Turning, a podcast about music, place, and change, co-produced by Newworks Calgary in partnership with CJSW Campus and Community Radio. My name is Rebecca Bruton. Today I'm speaking with experimental jaw harpist, actor, and writer Darcy Spidle, who releases work under the name Chick White and is based in West Chesetcook, Nova Scotia. This podcast was recorded at Mokinstis in Treaty 7 territory, the traditional homelands of the Blackfoot Confederacy, Siksika, Kainai, Piikani, as well as the Yahake Nakoda and Tsutina nations. This territory is also home to the Métis Nation of Alberta, Region 3, within the historical Northwest Métis homeland. How's your day so far?
Oh, not too bad, not too bad. It's very nice here in Chesetcook. I got out for a little walk, and I've been just editing video most of the morning, which kind of makes me crazy, but yeah, feeling okay. Yourself?
Yeah, it's been good. I used my neti pot.
Oh, nice.
Which felt great. So I'm feeling nice and clear.
I got into spraying saline solution up my nose once COVID hit. And I really enjoy it.
Yeah, it's great.
Same as a neti pot, but it's a similar sensation, I'm sure.
Yeah, basically the same. The saline spray is a little more intense. Mm-hmm. The neti pot's like very gentle draining. Yeah, super lovely thing.
Now, I don't mean to talk about neti pots to start this off. We don't have to put this in, but I am curious. Like, I find with the spray, I kind of snort it up my nose, but I know with the neti pot, it's supposed to go in and come out, and you don't necessarily, you don't snort in the solution.
No.
You just sort of let it run from one nostril to the next. I can never make that happen. So
is it like, is the thing that you spray up, is it water that's spraying up or is it a mist that's spraying up?
I guess it's like a mist. It's a watery mist.
Okay.
I mean, I feel liquid go up into my sinuses when I breathe it in.
Interesting.
Sort of like a nose spray or something like that. But I don't think I'm doing it right. I think you're supposed to use it the same as the neti pot, where you spray it and it kind of just finds its way out the other nostril, which I haven't been able to do. Yeah, I'm not sure why, but I found a way that works for me.
Great, great. So the question that I often start off these interviews with is, what have you paid the most attention to today?
Probably this video I've been working on, which I'm making a short film about this horn that I have. And so I've been quite focused on that film for the last few days. Other than that, maybe my dog. That's been about my day.
The horn that you have, is that related to the video that you're working on?
I could talk about this horn that's entered my life last year. I gave a talk at the art college in Halifax, NASCAD, and I met some students, and one of them was making this steel alphorn as his project for the year. I think it might have been a thesis project, but I'm not sure. It seemed quite interesting, and he gave me the horn a couple months later because he liked what I did with jaw harps and thought I might be able to do something with his horn. I started on a journey with that horn, sort of playing it every day and filming it as well. And it's a steel horn that's full of rust, and it's every day there's new holes in it, and it looks very corroded and dangerous. And so I've just been exploring it in different ways, visually and sonically. And so I did some really close up filming of the horn, and I've just sort of pieced it into a short film of sort that I've been working on. So yeah, part of a series of films I'm doing about my instruments called altered voicing. So it's kind of been my latest project.
Is the corrosion on the horn, is that part of the art project?
I think it ended up being part of the art project. It wasn't that corroded when I got the horn, but I've played it a lot, and it's always full of saliva, and it's causing a lot of rust. And I like that. I like how it affects the sound and the look of the horn. I do a lot of epoxy resin on the horn. When I was using it a lot, I was sort of epoxying it every weekend, just to fill in the holes that were occurring. But I haven't been playing it as much lately, so I haven't done any work on the horn. But yeah, I really like that aspect of it.
So this is a Swiss Alp horn.
I'm reluctant to call it a Swiss Alp horn because it's made of steel, and it's more like a cyberpunk horn or something like that. But it's built in the style of an Alp horn, yes. I've never played a real Alp horn, so I can't compare. But similar.
Playing the Alphorn, it seems like a new project that you're pretty excited about. And on some of the recordings you sent me, I was also hearing a bugle of some sort, solo horn.
Right.
And right, yes. So I'm curious about how that's different from the jaw harp technique.
I'm reluctant to call myself a horn player of any kind, but I these instruments sort of came into my life and I started to explore them. The bugle was a toy bugle that the director of the movie I was working on just left in the lunchroom, and I started playing around with it. It's you know, on a basic level, it's very different. I'm blowing through a pipe. Although the jaw harp, it works with the harmonic series, as do these horns, which are all, I don't know if you'd call them natural horns. I think that's probably reserved for natural French horns, but you know, just an open pipe. So they play the harmonic series in the same way that the jaw harp plays the harmonic series. And I found that an interesting connection. But I'm also just sort of, I'm improvising in a similar way with the horns, sort of taking a similar improvisational approach. Same thing I do with the jaw harps.
So can you describe a typical session where, my understanding is that you go outdoors and play the jaw harp. Can you describe what that sounds like or looks like for you?
Well, I haven't been going outside as much. Earlier on, that's how I started playing jaw harp. I moved to the country. Someone gave me a jaw harp as a birthday present, and it was an instrument I could put in my pocket, and I'd take it on hikes, and it seemed to respond well to the sounds of bugs and the sounds of waves, and it was a very meditative instrument. So, I really fell in love with it early on, and did a lot of recordings in the early days. Where I, you know, sit on a rock, listening to the waves and playing jaw harp, and that was a big part of how I started. And as time went on, I got more interested in close miking and sort of marrying the sounds of my mouth with the sounds of the jaw harp. And at this point, I haven't been doing a lot of outdoor playing with the jaw harp. But it certainly was something I did early on.
So I'm curious. I've got a few questions here. The first is, so I know your music. I think I got a tape from Arachnidiscs that had my friend D. Alex Meeks, otherwise known as Holiday Rambler, side, and then it had you on the other side. Yes. And lovely tape and really interesting pairing. I listened to it quite a bit, actually, because of how minimal they both are in different ways, both minimal and droney, but then one side features words and song form, and then your side does not. But prior to your foray into the jaw harp, you were participating in noisier collective music. On your website, you describe your crust punk band, The Hold, and a doom metal outfit, as well as an art-damaged noise rock trio. These descriptions also reveal to me that you are a writer. And then you also ran Divorce Records for several years. And so I'm curious about... what do you feel is the connection for you between those kinds of projects, which are more maximalist, and then the jaw harp, which is minimalist, but then also has kind of a grotesquery to it? Can you talk about that?
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it is the exact opposite in some ways of what I was doing. And a lot of this happened when I moved to the country. I was living in the city. I'd played in bands most of my life, actually. Then I moved to the country, and I had a kid. I had a daughter. And so it changed everything for me. Where I was once going to band practices and hanging with my band friends, things changed and I was sort of at home all the time, a bit isolated. And so the jaw harp was a great companion and a really big change for my musical activity. I was in the bands. In The Hold, I was a vocalist, and I was a drummer in the band Vent, which was kind of a doom metal band, and I was a drummer in the band Attack Mode. And I always enjoyed exploring the sounds of my voice in The Hold through screaming and grunting, and I guess that I guess that transfers to how I play jaw harp, especially now, because I do sort of incorporate a lot of vocal sounds in my playing. One interesting thing, and I've talked about this before, is in The Hold, I really damaged my voice. I'd go on tour and then not be able to speak for a couple of weeks when I'd return. And so I have a lot of scar tissue in my throat. And when I play jaw harp, I really try to tease out some of those sounds, some of the damage in my throat, in the way I play jaw harp. I think it's there, and that's a connection, I guess. I haven't really intellectualized the connection between my days in The Hold and my days playing jaw harp, but I see art as just one journey through life, and it seems like every year something new comes along, and it is informed by what came before, but it has a life of its own as well. So, I can't really articulate these connections, but I know they're there.
And what was your attraction to moving into a rural environment and then proceeding to stay there?
Yeah, I mean, I loved living in the city, and it was a big part of my life. And I ran my label in Halifax, and I ran a festival called Obey Convention for like 10 years while I lived in the city. So I was very connected. But when we had a kid, just couldn't afford to stay in the city was really the main reason we moved. We found a 100 and big part of my life, and I ran my label in Halifax, and I ran a festival called Obey Convention for like 10 years while I lived in the city. So I was very connected. But when we had a kid, just couldn't afford to stay in the city was really the main reason we moved. We found a 130-year-old house out in the country that needed a lot of work, but it was something we could afford, and the mortgage payment was about the same as our rent in the city. So we made the move, and I didn't know what to expect, but I don't regret it at all. I live by the ocean. I live in front of a salt marsh where the tides come in and go out every day. And it was a change of pace and a way of connecting to the natural world that it had a great effect on my mental health. And my art making, I'd say.
Now, I know I've seen on your Instagram feed pictures and perhaps videos of you actually going out into the salt marsh, sometimes getting really muddy. Is that a specific practice that you have, or is it more of an informal thing?
Well, it was a short film that I made called Marshlands, and I made that film near the start of the pandemic, when things were really locked down, and I started just hiking around the marsh every night just to kind of keep my head together. Everybody was walking all the time, and I started having strange dreams about the marsh and the idea of being absorbed by it. And so those videos, that film sort of came out of exploring those feelings and journaling about them and improvising with video and sound. And so then I ended up making that short as the final result of that process.
It reminds me a little bit of Alan Moore's Swamp Thing.
Okay, yeah.
Are you familiar with that?
I haven't seen that, no. I'm gonna write
it. Oh, it's a comic
book. Alan Moore, yeah.
So do you know who Alan Moore is?
No, I don't.
Yeah, so he wrote Watchmen, which is, it's a big Hollywood franchise, but he's refused to be a part of any of that and has lost out on a lot of money in his life as a result.
I bet,
but
yeah.
He's really into, he's a comics writer, and he's most known for Watchmen, which really took off into a realm of the nature of time. And there's a character named Dr. Manhattan who's like, was in a nuclear accident, as they are in these stories. But then is able to move atoms around. So it's a comic book, but then it also deals with these physics conundrums. And Swamp Thing was his take on a character that had existed for quite a while. And then he took a more philosophical bend to it. It's essentially a man who becomes a vegetable. And it was always believed in the prior comics world that that vegetable was still very much the man. But then Alan Moore's take on it was that there's no man left, and it's a vegetable that's trying to be that person. So the comic is all about this swamp, this animate swamp creature who keeps becoming reabsorbed into the swamp and then takes on a form as this human consciousness. It's super interesting in terms of like pop culture, but then combining with some deeper ideas about ecology, which is sort of, I think, something that also attracts me to what the various projects that I've seen you work on and heard you work on, in that there is very much a DIY aesthetic to it and a viscerality. But then I also get this sense of there's folds opening up in the ways that I experience, say, an outdoor environment and think about it, or a body. And the ways that I hear your throat, damaged throat sounds coming in.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I the idea of being absorbed by the natural world is sort of a concept that's always with me. You know, I long for the day that I just compost into the marsh, you know. I feel it's our ultimate fate, you know, and I think about the tides coming up and washing over my house, and you know, my body sinking into the marsh. All that is I don't know, reassuring in some ways, you know. And so it probably does, it's a concept that probably does permeate my work, I'd say, for sure.
And is that something that you're intuitively drawn to, like you feel your body just moving in that direction, or is it something that is like philosophical for you?
I don't know, I have some Buddhist leanings, you know, where I feel I don't know, that my consciousness is, you know, extends beyond me in some ways. I'm pretty fascinated with the idea of panpsychism, that all things are conscious. And this film I've been working on lately is sort of about, you know, transcending your body, or it's a metal cage in the film, but I love that idea of just like escaping all the boundaries of your consciousness and your body, and just entering into everything around you. And so, you know, on a philosophical level, I like that idea. And I like just the biological idea of just decomposing and turning into everything around you, and feeding the ground, feeding the marsh. I don't know. Those are just concepts that sort of stick with me, and I find compelling.
Is the film you mentioned, is that Tin Can you were talking about?
Not Tin Can. I've been making a series of shorts, and they all have sort of a philosophical bent to them. But Tin Can's a film that I co-wrote with Seth Smith, who's my writing partner. We've made three films together. Tin Can was sort of has some of those elements, actually. It's about people trapped inside of cryo chambers, and then waking up in a undefined future where a parasite, a sort of fungal parasite has sort of taken over the world and has become the inheritor of the earth, I suppose. And people are sort of navigating their way in this new environment. That's, I guess, the philosophical take on the movie. But yeah, and so I guess that's a similar theme, where there's a biological entity that's more powerful than the human species.
Interesting. So I haven't seen the film, but I get the sense just based on watching the trailer that it's kind of a campy horror film, which I love. I'm wondering, would you use the term camp? Does it live in that world?
Our films, I mean, there's a B movie element to what we do, I think, and they're kind of ridiculous in a way, but I wouldn't, I think they're quite philosophical. And Tin Can, as far as what I've how it's been reviewed, people seem to think it's quite nihilistic and dark. Without maybe when I think campy, I think funny, you know, and I don't think of the movie as funny. It's kind of lo-fi for a sci-fi movie, for sure, but I think it's quite dark, and that movie's does have a serious, probably a serious vibe, maybe a little more so than our last two.
Now, my sense of writing a narrative for a drama like that is that it follows a bit of a different rhythm and sense of meaningfulness than, say, a minimalist drone album. So I'm curious about how your brain applies creative development processes to, say, a bio sci-fi horror film like Tin Can versus, either your long form nature recording or work with the rusted horn.
Yeah, it's an interesting that's a good question. I when it comes to music and Jahar playing, and I call myself a Jahar player primarily. I'm very reluctant to call myself a horn player, but I've been quite interested in them lately. But for music, I take a generally think of myself as an improviser above even, a musician. I'm sort of a sound maker, and I'm always sort of searching for the right approach to improvisation, and getting in the right mental state and philosophical state, and trying to understand, how to play free form, trying to break away from rhythmic conventions and melodic conventions. And so it's a very different mental state than sort of constructing a plotted screenplay, which has to tell a story and follow certain conventions. And I find navigating between those two modes of thinking quite challenging, actually. And for filmmaking, I just wrote a script on my own, but I mostly write with Seth, who's the director, Seth Smith. And I think I do bring sort of a more freewheeling approach to writing, which I think is a bit of a contrast to Seth's more structured thinking. But yeah, I mean, I try to find a balance between, writing something that's interesting and a bit exploratory, and sort of creating a screenplay that has a structure and an audience can follow. And I one of probably one of the criticisms of our film is that they are a bit too experimental. But I think that's the way I like it. But it is quite different from how I think about music.
How do you define experimentalism?
I kind of use it as a catch-all, really. I know some people don't like the word experimental music, and because there's a whole canon of music that's related to experimental music, and I get that, but I think I use it sometimes just to I don't know, separate what I do from more conventional forms of music. But experimental music, I think it's, when you're setting out to play music and you don't know what the result is going to be. I think that's one way you could look at an experiment. So that would be experimental music, and I think my music kind of fits that definition. When I play a show or do a recording, I don't play, I never play the same thing twice. I don't know how it's going to end up. So I think that is makes it a bit of an experiment, although there are, limitations and certain gestures that repeat, and yeah. So yeah, that's a hard question.
Also act in some of your films and have a hilarious IMDb bio, which I
Oh,
love.
do I?
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Oh,
Yeah. At the end of it says that you also are known as a avant-garde Jawhart player after listing your film credentials, which I love. But acting is kind of, well, what you were saying about being absorbed by the salt marsh, it sounds like you have sort of this like whole body inclination, and I'm wondering if acting is a bit connected to that.
Acting has been an interesting development in my life. I never expected to be an actor, and didn't necessarily have an interest in acting, but I started acting. Well, I used to do some skits with my brother when I was younger, just comedy skits, but my first serious acting gig was probably our first movie, Low Life, and I only did it because we couldn't afford actors. And I'd sort of written the character and understood the character, so that was my first time acting, and I quite enjoyed it. And I guess, yeah, that idea of embodying another person almost is quite fascinating to me. And I've come to really enjoy acting, and because I don't have any acting training, I take that approach where I sort of just live in the character's world. Before I do any acting, before I get in front of a camera, and I quite enjoy that. I find it very intense. I just did a I don't do a lot of acting, but I did act in Tin Can, where I played a sort of a like I think three different cyborg characters, and yeah, for that character, I would wear like painful wooden insoles for 14 hours a day, just to sort of feel in pain all the time, like the character in the movie. I acted in The Sinner, which is a TV show. I just had a small part in that show last year, and I played a real bad guy. So I carried a knife around for a couple weeks, and I didn't sleep for 3 days before I did the role, and all just to sort of get into another person's mindset, So yeah, that's I really enjoy that. It takes a lot out of me, but yeah, it's an interesting process.
So then there's also quite a difference between walking around on wooden insole shoes and carrying a knife around with you, to my sense of what long form nature recording might be.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
And so sort of the sense that, or one of the senses that I love from talking to you is that in a way it seems filled with paradox, in that you're very much, you're living in a rural environment, but then you're participating in these parts of the art world that are quite, there's kind of a violence to it.
Maybe.
And then like really blending the mouth with the jaw harp, that could take on a really sort of serene pastoral type of framework around it. But then in your case, you're dealing with the scar tissue in your throat. So I love this sort of like punk noise sensibility, horror sensibility, but then there's also this real reverence for the places that you're existing in. Can you talk about those, some of those paradoxes, and maybe if you want to also talk about your practice as a nature recordist?
Yeah, the paradoxes. I mean, I guess, yeah, I suppose you're, I don't know, I look at horror and sci-fi as kind of, I think there's a beauty to it. You know, there's, I like to think of like all the movies we've written, there's sort of a philosophical element. There's sort of always some element of transcendence involved, even if it's quite dark. I am interested in sort of the dark side of human existence and exploring that and finding beauty in that. I don't feel paradoxes. I am involved in a lot of different projects and they seem quite diverse, but they feel like they fit together in my mind, you know. It's hard to articulate that though. As far as nature recording, I think that has something to do with, you know, living in nature. I'm not in the most rural place in the world, but I can get to some fairly quiet places, and I just really enjoy meditating on quiet sounds, just for, on a mental health level, you know. Yeah, I'll sit by the water and just listen to waves for, you know, hours at a time. And it's a meditative practice, really. And I try to capture that with the recordings. I was always a big fan of noise music. When I ran my label, you know, I put out some noise albums, brought a lot of noise acts to Halifax. And I find wave recordings the ultimate noise music, you know. It really does inform, the sound of waves really does inform how I play music as well, because it has a pulse, but it's not necessarily rhythmic. There's a certain chaos to the sound of waves if you really listen to them. They're unpredictable. It's this strange mix of non-rhythmic and rhythmic music, you know, a wave. And I really started just hyper focusing on the sound of waves. And I have put out two collection of wave recordings. You know, they don't fully capture the experience, but it's something, right? And there's lots of things I take from listening to nature or birds. I got really into listening to birds last year. I got a parabolic dish microphone and I started capturing songs of different birds in my neighborhood. And I thought a lot about how, you know, each bird, it just has it has a few songs, you know, and it does them. It just, each bird has a vocabulary and it doesn't try to reinvent the wheel or, you know, try to be super intellectual. And I sort of think of my own music that way, right? I have a vocabulary and I do a certain thing. And there's all kinds of connections I make with these things, but I don't know if they make any sense.
Well, I want to comment on the bird song. When I was listening through the recordings you sent, I think it was again in the Solo Horn album, there is a track where it really, I wasn't thinking about bird song because what I had heard previously was like a lot of clicking sounds, and like very satisfying, like small sounds. And then there's one recording that just has these, it's like a very florid cacophony of these tiny little florid melodic figures almost. And mm-hmm. I was really interested because as I was listening, I was like, this is like listening to a bird just hanging out in a tree, but then it's not really using, like, you're not really emulating the timbral sound that a bird makes, but in terms of temporality, like how music and sound are taking up space over time, very much bird song and like the ambience of non-human nature.
Yeah, so well, the secret to that track is that I'm not playing the bugle in that track, and I probably should mention that, but it is a nose whistle, and I find the nose whistle very bird-like. And so with that recording, one thing I really enjoyed about making those recordings was that we had this huge warehouse, and there was just an incredible amount of reverb in there. And I think that's sort of one of the defining features of the whole album, really, is the sound of this crazy warehouse and how much everything echoes. And I thought the nose whistle worked particularly well in that building. The sounds just sort of carried forever and doubled over on themselves. And yeah, so that's a nose whistle. And I play a nose whistle on a few of my albums. I like the instrument quite a bit. But
it's interesting. It like I've got a few clay bird whistles that I really love, and nose whistles kind of similar, but it's almost a bit more sensitive.
Mm-hmm. They're difficult. I find with nose whistles, I haven't found too many players of the nose whistle who it's not an instrument that's very true. You know, it's really hard to sort of hold a note. On the nose whistle, it just fluctuates so much. But I've found a way of playing it where I kind of play it like a jaw harp more so, where everything's sort of staccato, and I like that sort of mode of nose whistle playing. There's some nose whistle in that Marshlands short as well.
So in your email to me, you mentioned that you have a collaboration right now with the composer Becca Sims. Mm-hmm. And I'm so curious about how that process is going for you and also what that music might sound like. 'Cause she's such a composer. And your process, as I understand it, is very improvisational and intuitive. So I'm just curious about how that came about and what kinds of practices and ways in you've been participating in with her.
Mm-hmm. Well, it came about, I guess it was 2000, right before the pandemic. I played a show at the CMC, is that what it is? Mm-hmm. Canadian Music Center in Toronto. And a show that Nick Storing put together. He has a series there. And Becca Sims was in the audience and really liked the set. And she was talking to Nick about possibly writing a concerto for me. So I got wind of this and we connected and started down that road. So I don't know how to read. Well, yeah, I don't really know how to read music or a score or anything like that. So I wrote sort of a notation for Becca to use to make this concerto. So yeah, I did. I guess it would have been early 2020. I wrote this notation. So every along with a sort of a recording library. So I captured. It was a collection of sort of improvisations that had certain parameters, played on certain harps. And they each had a name, and then I did record some more structured utterances with the jaw harp, and made another library of recordings of those. And so I gave that all to Becca, and she's using it to write the concerto. So it's yeah, sort of based on a notational system that I came up with myself. So we'll see how it goes. I'm going to Toronto in October to sort of workshop the concerto with her, and then I think it's going to be performed in 2023 with Continuum, I think is the organization. So it's a big project. I'm quite intimidated by it, actually. I hopefully I'm going to work my butt off, and we'll see how it goes. I really enjoy Becca's work, all the pieces I've heard of hers. Yeah, that's why I just was all for it when I heard she was interested. But it's a challenge, and I don't know that there's been a jaw harp concerto since the 1700s. Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there might be, but you know,
Is
it's
there
not
actually
something.
a like a formalized concerto in existence?
There were. It was the composer. I can never pronounce his name. Albrechtsberger, in the 1700s. He was an Austrian composer. And he wrote, I think, seven jaw harp concertos at that time, and I think four of them still exist. I actually purchased one from an Austrian sheet music website just a few months ago. I've been trying to learn it, trying to teach myself music, just to learn this concerto. But yeah, they were very serious concertos. The players would have to they were required to play four jaw harps at once, which is sort of an old Austrian style. And so I've been teaching myself that technique and trying to learn this concerto. I don't know if I ever will. I find it's quite difficult, and reading music for jaw harp I find quite difficult because it's sort of all internalized with the harmonic series. But yeah, it's really sort of changed my perspective to go through that sheet music and to think about you know, those concertos from so long ago, and what the jaw harp meant in those times in that part of Europe. So yeah, that's and I think we're going to try to take some phrases from one of those concertos and incorporate them in Becca's concerto. So I'm kind of working on that now, doing some recordings of a few of the phrases from the centuries old concerto.
That's wild thinking about. I'm so curious about if those older concertos were performed at some point, what it was like for the ears of that century and that time period to hear that. And also, I didn't know, do you know if the jaw harp was sort of a traditional Austrian instrument at all? Like, is there folk repertoire from that area?
You know, the jaw harp, it's a very pan-cultural instrument. You find it all over the world, which is something I really like about it. But there is a German and Austrian tradition, and I can't, Maultrompel, I think is how they pronounce it in Germany and Austria, and I might have pronounced that wrong. But yeah, that multi-harp technique was sort of the tradition of the day. There was a German virtuoso from early 1800s and some before him, Carl Uhlenstein, who played he played multiple harps at once and would play classical repertoire. Yeah, so there is definitely a tradition in Germany, Austria, and throughout Europe of Jahar playing that goes back centuries.
And it's interesting. I wonder, do you know? So I know, particularly in the 1800s, there's a big romantic nationalist initiative to go find so-called dying folk traditions and turn them into nationalist music. But 1700s is kind of before that. So I'm so curious what the context for that piece would have been.
I'm not sure he was fascinated by the instrument. Apparently saw there were certain virtuosos around at the time, I guess, who would tour throughout Europe with jaw harps, and they were a bit of a novelty, I guess. But apparently this composer saw one of these performers. My guess is that he wrote the concertos for a particular performer, because I can't see that too many people would be able to play this. The jaw harp was always sort of a it was a folk instrument, you know, that wasn't necessarily taken seriously, besides these few virtuosos that were around at the time. So I feel like these concertos were written for a particular player. But that's hard to say. And there are modern recordings of two of these concertos that you can find on YouTube, Spotify. Yeah, I try to imagine what it would have sounded like, you know, back in the 1700s. It's one of the fascinating things about, you know, early music, just trying to picture what it would have sounded like, you know. And with the jaw harp, it's such a quiet instrument. The idea that these people would play without amplification, it just blows my mind. I mean, Carl Uhlenstein ended up losing both his front teeth from playing jaw harps. And I imagine part of it would be that he had to play them so loudly. You know, it's a dangerous activity for sure.
For such a small little thing.
And playing in these halls, you know, I just don't, I can't even. I guess there's good acoustics in a lot of these European concert halls, but still, to play with other instruments, I find, you know, when I'm collaborating, you know, if I don't like playing with, you know, an instrument even as loud as a saxophone, you know, it's like it's you get drowned out even with microphones. So it's very fascinating to me.
So winding down, is there anything that you're listening to these days that you could recommend to anyone listening to this podcast?
Oh, well, you know, I just got out of this very intense period of screenwriting where I wasn't listening to much of anything. And so I was worried you'd ask that question, because I haven't really been listening to much. I was very focused on those concertos, was the last thing I sort of listened to. And I was listening to some Mozart horn, the Mozart horn quintet, I think it is, while I was trying to learn how to read music for my horn collection. But so yeah, mostly just old classical music was sort of the last thing I was interested in. And now I've sort of been just going through a lot of my own recordings. And you know, I hate to admit it, but I sometimes spend most of my time listening to my own music and mixing it, and sort of coming up with new concepts. So I don't know if that's a good approach as an artist or not, but
Well,
it's
I
the
think
truth.
it's, I mean, I value the idea of making music that you want to hear. And so if you're not hearing it anywhere else, you might as well, listen to what you've made.
That's not true, though. I mean, I do enjoy music, and I sometimes go through some pretty intense periods of listening to music. But I find I can't, for one, when I write, I can't listen to music, because I find it distracting, and I just need silence. And I really crave silence in general, which is very hard to find. And I actually sort of deal with some kind of mental health issues when it comes to noise and silence. So I'm always searching for some peace for my ears, you know. But yeah, but you know, I've been listening to a lot of hip hop with my daughter as well. But I don't know if this is the right podcast to talk about 21 Savage and the like.
Thanks for listening to The Drop and the Turning. The music you heard in today's episode, in order of its placement within the interview, was Intro, from a collaboration between Chick White and Philadelphia guitarist Bill Nace. That album is called Off Motion, and it will be released later in 2022. XY3 Rat, from a split with Vancouver noise artist Hermit, also to be released later in 2022. Excerpt from part 2 of Wind Wound by Chick White, coming out this winter. Excerpt from the 2004 record Noise Blood Assault by The Hold. Erasing from the aforementioned Bill Nace collaboration. Joseph from the Hermit split. Nose Wires from Solo Horn, out now on Soundholes. And finally, what you're hearing now, an excerpt from Johann Georg Albrechtsberger's Concerto for Jawharp, Mandora, and Orchestra.